This evening, I was asked to give a talk on just the subject of what's the right frame of mind to meditate with? What's the right attitude that we should bring to meditation? And I think this is a very relevant subject for those who are interested in calming the mind and developing clarity. So firstly, I will say that what is meditation? Well, we have to know what meditation is before we can know what's the right attitude we should have towards meditation. In Buddhist meditation, the word meditation has a very broad meaning. It is the cultivation of the mind, it is cultivation of virtue, it is cultivation of your body, cultivation of wisdom. This is what we mean by meditation. Meditation doesn't just mean sitting, as we did a moment ago, with our eyes shut on the meditation cushion. It means to cultivate, to grow spiritually, to mature as a wise, compassionate, sensitive and intelligent human being that lives in this world with peace, tranquility and great compassion, and also understands the world, the nature of the world and how the world is. And so meditation in Buddhism means to cultivate. And to come back to the first question, what's the right attitude for cultivation? And one of the first things that we have to have is a sense of openness of mind, don't we? Openness of mind to discover. Just like when we come along to this center, for many of us it's new. And we have to have that sense of inquiry, the willingness to discover, to learn, to search. And to look, to listen, to absorb. And it's that openness, the beginner's mind, the mind which wants to know, which wants to discover, which has the potential to take in new information, new experiences, and to learn about oneself. So this quality of openness is actually extremely important in the cultivation of the spiritual path and in the cultivation of the mind. Openness doesn't mean that we believe everything we're told. Actually, in Buddhism, the Buddha said, if you do not know for yourself, then don't take it on board yet. It's only when you know and understand for yourself that you can truly say, yes, now I comprehend. Now I understand. Then it becomes your own wisdom, your own knowledge. And that's when you can say, yes, I have truly seen. I truly know this as it is. Because you know, not because somebody else does. And so to experience that knowing, we have to have the sense of inquiry. Like the person who wants to know truth, wants to know how the universe works, wants to experiment, wants to discover. They seek and search for information, for knowledge. And to do that, they have to have a mind which is not full of preconception first. Because if we have too many preconceptions, it immediately blocks us from seeing reality. There's that famous saying about eminent scientists. They say the degree that a scientist is considered the most eminent in his field is the degree to which he holds up development in that field of science. Because often, just through his reputation or her reputation, and eminence, they have a certain view, certain attitude, and because that is such a predominant view and attitude and theory that tends to suppress the development of new understandings, new knowledge, new insights. So that person's eminence clutters, holds up and hinders development in that area of science. And if we come with the mind to meditation with a certain view about ourselves, certain attitudes to who we are and our personality and our feelings about ourselves, then often that gets in our way, doesn't it? We have certain feelings. I was speaking to somebody recently who was feeling very depressed. And that mere depression was getting in their way towards developing a new attitude towards themselves, because the outlook was that they were an unpleasant, lonely, miserable person. That was what they expressed about themselves. They didn't see anything good in themselves and weren't open to the potential. And that view, that attitude, was blocking themselves from seeing something else, from discovering the wholesome, the good, the kind, the pleasant qualities within themselves. And so it's how we approach the mind, how we approach ourselves, how we approach the world, and how we approach the meditation, which is going to set up the attitude. So when we come to sit meditation or in daily life, we're trying to develop openness. The openness to take in new information, take in new experiences, take in new knowledge. And in meditation, for example, just in sitting meditation, you're going to experience new things. You're going into the unknown, the realms of the mind. Some of it will be a very pleasant journey. Some of it will be very unpleasant. In meditation, if you only want to go into the realms of the pleasant, you want to go into the fun house at the pleasure parlor and not into the horror house, then you'll miss out so much and ignore so much, block out. In meditation, what we're trying to do is open up to know, to learn everything that can come up in the mind about our experience, ourselves, and what potentials are there, but also what we can know. So whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, we're willing to look. We're willing to know it. So if you see happiness and joy, oh, that's wonderful. If you see sadness and depression, ah, that's wonderful. It is. For the meditator, that is wonderful. Ah, one is detaching from the emotion that is my sadness and depression, negativity, and saying, this is the experience. There is the experience of just this much arising and passing away. And in meditation, one has the openness to allow things to arise and allow things to pass away. Some people have the openness to allow things to arise, so they'll let experiences come up and enjoy the experiences of life, but they don't have the openness to allow things also to pass. I was speaking to a lady very recently, who was very upset. Her son had passed away very young in an accident. And her biggest difficulty was allowing that to happen. Her mind was saying, it shouldn't happen. It mustn't happen. It couldn't have happened. I deny that is a possibility in my life. And because of that denial, that resistance, that lack of openness to allow a person to come into one's life as one's son, and then also to leave. The inability to allow that person to also go was not there. There was a resistance. And because of that resistance, there was tension, conflict, suffering, and pain in the heart. And so the openness of mind we have in meditation is to allow things to come in and also allow them to go out. Now, to have that openness, we have to have also the ability to not just select, do we? If we just say selecting the things we like and denying the things we don't like, then what's going to happen? There will be resistance, suffering, and pain. Is it possible we can just allow pleasant experiences and deny unpleasant? It's like saying here, in this hall, I will sit here and only allow the people I like to come in this room, and those I choose not to like, I won't allow them to come in. And then you have to build walls. Then you have to build defenses. Then you're not open. But when the doors of this room, this hall, are open, you have to allow all possibilities, all potentials to come in, to abide, to sit down, to get up and leave. If I think no one should get up and leave during my talk, am I going to suffer? Of course I am. You allow the possibility. That is nature, the way things are. Do we stop things from leaving? Do we resist change? If we develop the attitude to allow change, then things arise and things go. People come into our life, and people go. Relationships grow and relationships pass. Emotions come and emotions go. We're developing the openness to allow it to happen. And openness means acceptance. When there is the ability to accept, then the mind is open. If you find that when you're doing sitting meditation, you're getting very tense, you'll note that that's the tendency to not be allowing. You're resisting or putting up barriers, putting up the walls of resisting change, not allowing something to come up. So just relax. Doesn't matter what's there. In meditation, you'll sometimes find very pleasant experiences can come up. Feelings of joy, feelings of rapture, lightness, pleasure. The meditation goes well. In other times, it's miserable. Legs are aching, your back's aching, it seems to drag on, you don't know what you're doing, don't know why you're doing it. Nothing seems to work. That's when we actually have to be very patient. Very patient, because that's the work. Not every day is payday. A lot of meditators want every day to be payday. They don't want to have a work day. The reason we get paid is because we've done the work. And same with the reasons we get very peaceful states on some sits during some periods of meditation and not others is because that's the payday, that's the result. The accumulation of those good qualities are conditioned and they arise and fruit at that time. Just like the fruiting of a tree. Trees do not fruit all year. They fruit in season, certain times. And it's the culmination of certain conditions, certain climatic conditions and weather conditions. When they are ready, then that tree will fruit. And so not only do we have openness in meditation, but we have to have great patience. Great patience, because we're learning something new. And when we learn something new, or even when we're dealing with something we've done for many years, we have to often be very, very patient with ourselves first, because there is a tendency for all of us to try to jump ahead, to get this step over and done with, and move on. I was speaking to a lady who comes to our monastery regularly, and she said the other day that every time she tries to take a shortcut to the monastery, it ends up being a long cut because she gets lost. And I've found that to be true in meditation, that every time I've been in a hurry to say, I'll get this stage over and done with, and I'll move on to the interesting bit, the interesting bit doesn't come up, because that tendency to be in a hurry is the opposite quality and the opposite attitude of mind to meditation. In meditation, you have to have a sense of you've got all the time in the world. And sometimes I try and develop that, because in a monastery with sometimes responsibilities in that, there's many responsibilities on your time. And you notice you get caught up if you allow the mind to get caught up in the schedule, the time, the sequence. And I purposely just stop and say, I've got all the time in the world. It doesn't matter. But all the time in the world. So when you're sitting down and going to meditate, have the attitude that you've got all the time in the world. To just give yourself attention. You're not doing it for anyone else. You're not doing the meditation to get it over and done with. You're taking your time. You've got all the time in the world to give your own mind full and complete and sustained awareness and attention. You've got all the time in the world to know one breath. There's no need to rush. There's nowhere to go but to be in the here and now. Just be here now. That's all we have to do. And when we actually start to say, oh, there's no rush, there's no hurry, we relax. There's a sense of ease in the mind. And it's a sense of contentment and ease, which is the precursor for happiness to arise in the mind. So just be very content with the present moment. Be at ease with the situation. Whatever's arising, just let it be. And just tell yourself, I've got all the time in the world. That's often one of the problems, isn't it, in daily life. That we feel we don't have enough time. We don't have enough time with our partners, with our children. We don't have enough time to ourselves. We don't have enough time to do the chores and the jobs that we'd like to do. We don't have enough time on holiday. So we have to develop the attitude of mind. Just stop. Be still. And that's what's coming along here and sitting still is. You're taking time out. Because time is just a concept of mind. If you think you have no time, then you don't have any time. If you think you've got all the time in the world, then you have. Just be still. So this is actually very important, to be very, very patient. And patience means the willingness to persevere. I remember reading a long time ago, I could have the figure wrong, but I think I'm correct, reading about Thomas Edison, who invented the light bulb. And evidently, if I remember correctly, he experimented over many different light bulbs, which didn't work. And he kept on repeating and creating and making light bulbs. And he did that over 4,000 times. I think it was 4,200 times, if I remember correctly, until he got a light bulb that worked. And that was pointed out as an example of perseverance. And in meditation, sometimes you have to try even more than that. Repeat it over and over again. Because what you're doing is you're opening up and looking into the mind. And each time you look into the mind, you'll see something different. Each time you look into the mind, you'll discover something else about yourself, about your feelings, about your moods, about the body, about consciousness, about perception. You'll discover all these new things. And so it's more information, more knowledge that you can use. But there has to be this ability to repeat, not to be discouraged, but to carry on, to discover, to look, to search, to look again, try again, to train. Because meditation is about training the mind. And training the mind doesn't come easy. Our mind has developed certain habits, certain habit patterns, certain tendencies, and certain temperaments. Some people have very effervescent, outward-going temperaments. Other people have speculative temperaments. Some people have fault-finding temperaments. Some people have a sensual temperament. There are endless aspects and characteristics that we find in both our temperament and our moods and in those of others. And so knowing what's the tendency of mind, what habit patterns do I get caught up in, what are the ruts that my mind falls in. For example, this is an example, do I tend to be very critical, judgmental? We can catch that habit, and then we could detach from it. Instead of saying, "Oh, that's me," we say, "Ah, the judgmental mind, the critical mind." And when we label it, it becomes more of an object rather than an aspect of me. And then we can just know it. Ah, oh, that's the judgmental mind coming up again. Ah, I know that pattern. I know that habit. Here we go again. And then there's the ability to step out of that habit pattern because we're putting a sense of aloofness and awareness around that pattern, around that tendency. The mind steps away. Steps away by knowing, ah, that's just one habit pattern. Maybe I can choose another habit pattern instead of falling into the habit pattern of negativity. Why not develop the habit pattern of goodwill and kindness? May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings be at peace. And that's a very positive tendency of mind. A habit pattern of compassion and loving kindness. And that's a very wholesome habit pattern which will lead to your happiness and to the happiness of others. a couple of other things that I want to talk about in this attitude is, one of the things is to not have expectations. We can find that when we have very high expectations, then we tend to strain too much in the meditation. Especially if you've ever experienced peaceful states of mind in your meditation, next time you come to sit, you want that to happen again. And often that desire is the very thing that stops you experiencing that state. And desire, craving, gets in the way. It blocks us from actually obtaining the goal. And that's why often you find that when we're new to meditation, because of that freshness of mind and we're not expecting anything, then the mind easily goes to peace. And it can have very pleasant experiences. But when we do have deep states of happiness arise, then desire comes up. And then expectation. Next time I have to go back there. Next time I should obtain that state. But the mind is not a machine. It will throw up new things to you and in your experience all the time. It will present new opportunities and new possibilities and new problems to deal with. So if you think you can repeat the old experiences in exactly the same way, then you're setting yourself up for blockage and failure. You need to use different techniques, different skills, on different occasions. And I'm talking from experience here because as a monk, often you go traveling when you get to five rains. After 5 years as a monk, you're expected to go off for traveling. And sometimes you go off and you go to this certain cave or a certain sort of forest on a mountain, and you have very good meditation there. And you think, that was wonderful, that was marvelous. Then eventually you end up coming back to your monastery. And for years afterwards, you can be longing to return to that cave, yes? And you think, if only I was back in that cave, my meditation would get back to that wonderful state. Here in this monastery, the abbot's giving me all these duties to do and responsibilities. Then finally, you get the opportunity to go back to that cave. And is it the same? It wasn't for me. So, and you find, because of the expectation, the memory, you make it much more than it was. Or even if it was wonderful, because you try to repeat that, you find it's subject to conditions, and the conditions are never exactly the same. The mind has changed, things have shifted, things have moved on. So we're not trying to repeat the old pleasures, the old happinesses. We're trying to discover here and now what's happening. What's causing happiness, and what is the cause for suffering? Where is the desire coming from? What is the hindrance? What is the block? This is what we look for. This is what we discover. This is what we try to uncover, to search out. Is there still desire coming in the mind? Is there aversion? Is there negativity? Is there frustration? Is there doubt? Is there restlessness? What's coming up? What's the hindrance to peace? And then we gradually overcome that and train the mind. So to not have expectations. We sit here just with an open mind. And sometimes if you have, say, an unpleasant experience in meditation, some people when they're sitting meditation have strange feelings arise in the body or strange perceptions arise in the mind. Then they get very frightened. Get very concerned. Sometimes when you're meditating and your body starts to relax, then all the nerve endings and the muscles are relaxing and some strange feelings can arise. Feelings that you're spinning, or feelings that you're falling over, feelings that you're falling into a well, or sensations that you're being bitten by thousands of ants, and tingling and tickling sensations. A vast array of sensations can arise in the body, and perceptions can arise in the mind. And sometimes people think, what's going on? Am I going to go crazy? And then, because it's happened once, they get very frightened to sit again, because they expect it. So what we do is just say, this is where we use wisdom. This experience, what can we know about it? So when it arises, you feel like you're being eaten alive by ants, you've got your eyes shut, just focus your awareness on that sensation. Is it permanent or impermanent? And notice, does the feeling change? If that feeling, that sensation is changing, then obviously it's impermanent. Is what has arisen now and then gone the next moment, can you take that to be you? Or is it just something which has arisen and passed away? If it has arisen and passed away, then it belongs to nature. Does not belong to you, because it's gone. And so this is where you place your wisdom faculty on the experience. And we don't expect anything. We just know. We know the characteristics of something, the characteristics of that experience. I know meditators who have their minds have become very peaceful, and then they've opened their eyes and looked at people and seen just skeletons sitting there. Or the person disappear. Everyone in this room just disappear before their very eyes. And then they've got very worried. What can you know about that? Perception has changed. The perception of people here is true. The experience of the perception of people disappearing, that has happened. Impermanence. So you take your refuge in the knowledge of the characteristic of that experience. It is impermanent. It is not you. It arises and passes away. And then we can take refuge in that wisdom, taking refuge in that aspect of nature, that aspect of truth. Another attitude that we need to develop in our meditation is to be very gentle. Very, very gentle. I particularly find that very prevalent here in the West. The need for us to all develop lots of loving kindness. Because I think in our society we've tended to develop a very fault-finding and critical, judgmental attitude of mind, not only to others, but also to ourselves. And a measure of that is, how many times today have you thought, may I be happy, may I be fully healthy, may I be well? And compare that to how many times today you may have thought you made a mistake, you did that wrong, you messed up there. All that negative judgment, that self-criticism, that self-analysis, and the self-hatred and fault-finding. Is that necessarily constructive? No, it's not that we don't criticize ourselves when we need criticism, but sometimes we also need to encourage ourselves, encourage the mind, give support to the mind, so it is inspired, it lifts up. It's just like a child, if we're just always criticizing that child, what will happen to that child's development, its kind of growth? We need to also give love and support and care for that child. And in many ways, the mind is the same way. We need to be gentle, be caring, be very kind, not only to ourselves, but to others. But not only to others, but also to ourselves. Have you noticed that when you're stressed and tense and negative, that not only are you upset with yourself, you tend to react to the situation, have a very short fuse. We tend to be prickly because of that sense of being stressed or not happy with ourselves. But when we're content and at ease and very happy and relaxed with ourselves and sense of well-being, then it's very easy to be kind and at ease with others, even when they're doing something that we don't agree with or like. And so being very gentle in meditation. Don't force the mind, but just gently taking one step at a time, being very relaxed about it, being at ease, and being very kind to yourself. People who meditate tend to become very kind to themselves because you're becoming your own best friend. You're becoming your own best friend with the mind. You're starting to look into the mind and getting to know your own mind. And you don't mind spending time with your own mind. That's exactly why monks can do long meditation retreats. In the Tibetan tradition, they have this tradition of doing a meditation retreat locked up in a cave for 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days. You have your food shoved under a hole in the rocks. And that's the meal for the day. And you're bricked up into the cave. And after 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days, the monks outside take down the bricks. And usually the monk wants to be bricked up for another 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days. Ajahn Brahma Wangso is doing a retreat for 6 months. I think he would like us to brick him up, but we've refused to do that. And I'm sure he also would like to continue on, because the reason you can spend such a long time by yourself is you're at peace with yourself and you've become your own best friend. And so we actually have to treat ourselves with a lot of kindness and get to know ourselves and become our own best friend. Sometimes we can be our own worst enemy. And we have to be very careful of that. We see that with great danger. Become your own best friend. Have an attitude of mind of great kindness and goodwill and care and gentleness. And also know that we make mistakes. It's okay to make mistakes. We make mistakes, try again, and move on. And also being open to being told that we've made mistakes. When I leave Bodhinyana Monastery, I've made a determination that I'm going to offer to all the monks to write a criticism, anything that I've done that they think I can improve on anything. Is there something about the way that I've led the monastery, looked after the monastery, administered the monastery, or my personality, my behavior? Is there anything that I can improve on, that I can change, that I can develop? What I'm going to suggest is that they write that down on a piece of paper and give it to one monk, and he types it up, so it's all the same typing, so I won't know who wrote it.
So I can completely be anonymous. And I can see that that's a very useful thing to do, because we grow through mutual admonition, which is based in kindness, not motivated by anger or negativity or a sense of revenge. With the community of monks, you know that they're motivated out of a wish for your personal growth, out of compassion, out of kindness. And we don't see certain qualities within ourselves. And sometimes other people can see where we can grow, where we can improve. And just having that knowledge can be very useful, especially if it's coming from the right place. And so we're developing an openness of mind to want to learn, to want to know, what can I change, what can I improve, what areas I don't see in my life, and how do I affect others. And when you take that information, then you can develop, grow, work on those areas, because you want to progress. If we don't want to change, we want to stay exactly as we are and don't want anyone to point out how we can change, then change will not occur. We'll stagnate. And so it's very important to be open to growth, open to recommendations. I would suggest that that's very difficult for husbands and wives to do. It can be, but it's actually a very good thing to be open to recommendations. I was just telling somebody a while ago, before coming over here, the story about the husband and wife. I don't know whether you know about feng shui, but in the Chinese tradition, it's called the sort of the energies of a house. And if you have your house lined up along certain energy lines, and you have the furniture in your house lined up along certain energy lines, then that house is either harmonious house or it's not harmonious. It's in disharmony. Well, a husband and wife were in disharmony, and the wife was always arguing with the husband and vice versa. And they were always pointing out each other's faults. And so the wife was fed up. She went to see a marriage guidance counselor. And she told him all about her problem with her husband. And after that, the marriage guidance counselor said to her, look, I can't really give you advice until I see you interacting together as husband and wife. So I suggest I come around to your house. So she invited him over. And after seeing them speak together and interact for a long period of time, he said to her, look, actually, there's nothing wrong with the way you interact. But by the way, I'm a feng shui expert, and the energies in your house are completely out of skew, completely misaligned. Your furniture is in disharmony. If you rearrange the mirrors so that it creates openness and you set up the furniture in a way that it's aligned, that will create much more harmony, and I'm sure your problems will be resolved. The wife was very cynical about this, but he said, give it a try. About a month went past, and he hadn't heard from the wife, the woman, and so he decided to give her a call and ask her how her marriage was going. And she said, oh, it's wonderful. My marriage couldn't be more harmonious. You're absolutely right. It was to do with the lining up of the furniture. And so the feng shui expert said, what did you do? And she said, well, it was simple. I just waited till my husband was out down the pub and shoved all the furniture against the front door. That's It's one way of resolving problems. The other thing that I wanted to mention this evening was to actually treat problems as challenges. And often we can get very weighed down by what comes up, you know, the difficulties and the negativity, the problems, resistance that is there. And you know, we see that often as personal failures. We have a difficult meditation once, we have a difficult meditation twice, third time, then we think, I'm no good at this. But actually, everyone else has that sort of experience as well. Sometimes it is difficult. Sometimes it will be painful. Sometimes it will not be easy. But it's the sense of challenge. Oh, this is interesting. What's going on here? We're looking for why it's not working. Not having the expectation that it should work. If we do it correctly, the Buddha said it will work. But in the way of making it work, we have to have the ability to say, why is it not working? What's in the way? And in the cultivation of the mind, if we're developing the mind towards peace, there's usually one of five things that are blocking us and hindering us from obtaining that peace and rapture and joy. And for many of you, you know those five things. It's either the desire for some sensual pleasure through the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the taste, and sense organs, the five sense organs. Or we're looking for that comfort through those sense organs. Or we've got restlessness in the mind. There's this lack of ability to just be still. We're always looking for pleasure somewhere else. Have you noticed actually sometimes how when you're home alone and you're totally bored, there's a sense of wanting to do something, have some distraction, have something happen, have somebody visit, have somebody call. There's a need there for something other than what's going on. And that's what this restlessness is. Restlessness means that one cannot be at rest. One cannot be still. One is not happy with what is happening. And so we search for something else to replace it. And so we search for food in the fridge. We search for entertainment on the television or at the movies. We search for distraction. We search away from ourselves and not to ourselves. Meditation is actually challenging those feelings. Why am I bored? I remember one of the Western monks who was in Thailand in the hot season. He was living in a tin roof hut in the middle of the hot season with all these, there's this little insect in Thailand which flies in your ears and into your eyes, and very, very distracting. And it was there was no repent from the heat, and nothing was happening, and he was bored stiff. And he decided that he was going to sit with boredom until it killed him. To just see if the feeling of boredom could actually kill him. Yes? And so he decided to sit and place his attention on boredom. Now that's actually very interesting. Have you ever tried to do that? Place your attention on what it feels like to be absolutely bored. Wholeheartedly bored, totally bored. And it's very interesting that boredom cannot resist attention to it. Boredom depends for its very existence on non-attention. on seeking for something other than what's there, not on the experience of what's actually happening. So if you're being bored by this talk, just sit with absolute boredom. What's it feel like to be bored to death? Yes? So what's it feel like? Place your attention on that feeling. And when you give your attention to it, it disappears, it changes. Because you're no longer seeking for something else, but actually staying with what is here and now. And you don't have to go anywhere to do that. And the more attention, the more awareness you place there, actually you're happy to be bored. And the boredom dies a very dull death. Yes. Through that attention. And so we can actually place our awareness and treat the things that come up in our experience as challenges. We can treat doubt as a challenge. What can I know about doubt? Doubt about ourselves, doubt about others, doubt about the path, doubt about our lives. What can you trust? The opposite to doubt is trust. What can you trust? Can you trust knowledge? Can you trust understanding? Have you found a refuge in yourself? Not a refuge dependent on others or external. Find a place where you truly trust your own wisdom, your own understanding. And so we challenge these difficulties, these problems that arise. Look at them in a different way. Can you be so aware of dullness that you wake up? Can you be so alert and mindful of the present moment that there's joy and happiness there, not dullness? So we overcome the hindrances to meditation by being aware of them, not by resisting them or blocking them or turning away from them or ignoring them. This is one of the attitudes of mind that we develop in meditation. So this evening, what I've tried to speak about is just how to approach the meditation when we sit, how to approach the cultivation of the mind by a sense of openness, sense of gentleness, great patience, and great kindness, and a sense of treating the difficulties and problems of life as not our problems, but just a challenge. Oh, this is interesting. How can I overcome this? And then we work, we gradually deal with the progress, and we step one closer freedom, one closer to understanding, one closer to enlightenment. So this evening, I think I have spoken long enough for this evening. I thank you for your attention. Is there any brief questions? Yes, Jim. Yes, you can. The question is that when you say have a sensation arising, how to deal with that, particularly if say you have very strong pains in the knees or the back or elsewhere, how to approach that. And there are many ways. One way is to completely ignore it, where rather than, because the mind can only know one thing any instant. The reason it sometimes feels like we're knowing a number of things is because the mind is so quick, it jumps. And so if we just place the mind on one thing, then it won't be aware of the other. So if you can place your mind so intently and sustain it so clearly on the breath, then all awareness of the body totally disappears. For a person who becomes very one-pointed on the breath, they have no body awareness. The body disappears. So that's the first way of dealing with pain. Make your body disappear by focusing. And that's very interesting. There have been many members of the Buddhist Society who have come along to practice meditation because of intense pain. It's a way of dealing with critical pain. They've learned how to meditate as a way of relief of that pain. And often what's happened is the pain has been so intense, they've spoken to me and they said that they have focused on another object because the pain was so intense they couldn't place their mind there, and the mind has gone into that object and the pain has totally disappeared. So try that out. Try that out. It's amazing when you think that this pain is unbearable, this pain is intense, this pain is endurable, and then suddenly it disappears exactly like that, in a flash, and the mind becomes very blissful. Then you start to see or start to be challenged. Am I pain? Was it my pain? What is the difference between pain and mind? What is happening here? That's one way of dealing with pain. Another way of dealing with pain is actually to, as I spoke a moment ago, to look at it. To focus your attention totally on the pain. Just as I said, focus your attention totally on boredom. Here you're going to focus your attention totally on pain. And the way we do that is actually we sit and just stay very mindful of the feeling without getting involved in the feeling. So there's maybe a hot sensation, a tingling sensation, the leg is falling asleep, intense pain. Just noting it. Intense pain, tingling sensation, hotness, heat. It's not me, it's not mine. Just noting. What's happening? What's there? Just know that. And as you know that, then the mind is aloof of the pain. It just knows and recognizes what's actually happening without judging, without desiring to experience or get rid of. Just knowing. And just stay with that quality of knowing the pain. And again, it's amazing, you can have great happiness in just knowing acute pain. And that you'll find that that is very, very, very useful when you're sick and ill and you can't get away from pain. This is how we train the mind in meditation experience for dealing with illness, old age, sickness, and death when the body breaks up. This is the practice. This is the training ground. Yes. The gentleman was saying that he was able to deal with severe tinnitus through meditation and deal with it successfully until it disappeared. That's right. Yes, yes. That's just one example of how you can focus the mind. Yeah, these things, often we try, because we don't know them, we're afraid of them. And all human beings, all creatures, are afraid of pain. So it's actually, for a meditator, this is actually saying, yes, I don't like this, but I'm willing to learn from it. And it's that ability to try to learn from it, that we can learn more skills, be more open, and develop greater understanding of of these experiences, which will happen and do happen. Yes? Usually that's the biggest fear is that suddenly when we're sitting for a long period of time, for example, where fear arises that something's going to happen serious. This leg is going to fall off, I'm going to do my knee in. It is possible that some people do overdo it, can cause serious injury, but what you find is if you gradually work step by step, dealing with more intense pain. For example, if you're sitting and you can sit comfortably for 30 minutes, the next time you sit for 35. And if next time you're sitting and you can sit regularly for 35 minutes, and no pain comes up, but then you know if you sit for 40 minutes or 50 minutes or an hour, pain's going to rise, then just gradually increase, step by step, an extra 5 or 10, 15 minutes. And even when you get to the point where the pain feels so intense you can't bear it, and say, okay, I can move in 5 minutes' time. Okay? Give myself permission to move in 5 minutes and then sit for that extra 5 minutes and just watch. Watch what happens. What's going on. And you see the mind struggle, it doesn't like it, but we're looking. What's going on? And so we gradually, it's just like any skill, any technique. We do it in stages, do it gradually. And as we get more confidence and more proficient, then we can sit for longer and longer periods of time. But we do it in stages, gently. But it's good to challenge, good to stretch the mind, stretch the knowledge, stretch the abilities. Firstly, if you're trying to calm the mind down, then you're not getting caught up in the thinking process, even thinking about the meditation. What you're doing is trying to stay with the knowing, so that if thinking arises in tranquility meditation, that is not necessary. What we're trying to do is stay with the physical process and be aware of just that. It's just like the analogy of the person floating on the water. And they're trying to just experience breathing naturally and feeling the waves go over them. But just stay afloat. But then they notice that their mind is wandering off and they're thinking about, dinner this evening or what's going to happen tomorrow. And then they catch themselves, come back to just experiencing floating. Be here, be here now. So then they relax and calm down and just experience the sensation of floating. So that's how we do this with tranquility meditation. Sometimes, if we're doing tranquility meditation, it works very well. But then we get to a point where pain interrupts meditation. We can't get calm. We can't relax. So then we may turn our attention to say, this I will know. And it's not worth thinking about pain. You're not trying to analyze pain with thought. You're just being aware. What's this feeling feel like? And the way we're aware is to look at its quality. And this is very important. Look at its quality. What's the quality of this feeling? Is it permanent or does it change? And just stay with that degree of knowledge. That's something you can know. Is it permanent or is it pulsating? Is it moving? Is it shifting? Is it vibrating? Is the intensity variating at any point? That we can know. That's changing. And when you know something's going to change, you lose your fear of it. If I tell you you're going to experience unbearable, intense, eternal pain, it becomes impossible, doesn't it? But if I say, oh, this pain that you're experiencing won't last, it becomes much more bearable, doesn't it? If I give you a job to do and say that it's going to last eternally, who would volunteer? If I give you a job to do and say, it won't last long, it'll be over in a few minutes, I'll probably get more volunteers. And when we see that something does shift, does change, then it becomes endurable. Even though the pain may be there for a long period, the very quality of the pain and the intensity of the pain is varying all the time. And that's where we stay with the knowledge. This is changing. And that's where freedom is, in the knowledge of change. That's the freedom of the Buddha. Know that this too will change.